Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since Donald Trump's Electoral College victory, the media have focused on the plight of working-class white voters who voted for him, but far less attention has been paid to the economic anxieties facing workers of color. Over a six-year period, today's guest, social policy expert Kristen Seifeld, interviewed 45 women in Detroit, mostly women of color, and she calls them strivers. They work, or they want to work, they attend post-secondary institutions, and they are or aspire to be homeowners. But despite their efforts to reach middle-class status, they remain poor or near poor. Some cling to a middle-class status that could easily be lost. Residential segregation and labor discrimination are major factors, but Seifeld argues that these families have been socially abandoned, caused by economic and policy changes. She writes, quote, "For these families, the promise of home ownership and education as tools for achieving upward mobility has been broken. The experiences of the Detroit area women in this study illustrate how social abandonment occurs across the country," end quote. Kristen Seifeld writes about their stories in her new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. Kristen Seifeld is Assistant Professor of Social Work and Public Policy at the University of Michigan, and she joins us from the Michigan News Studio in Ann Arbor. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I really enjoyed reading your book, and it's so timely. I wanted to start off by asking you, what are your thoughts on the media's focus on Donald Trump's working class voters, specifically white voters?
Well, I think, you know, in the aftermath of the election and some surprises about white working class voters who voted for Obama in the past and then switched to vote for Trump, I think, you know, some of that attention is warranted. But to exclude then any kind of focus on other workers who have also, you know, sort of been left behind and who face a lot of similar, if not sometimes worse, struggles, I think, you know, is problematic.
Can you elaborate on that? I mean, why do you think that the frame tends to be, you know, white or black? I mean, why does it have to be one or the other?
I mean, that, yeah, for better or for worse, that's sort of rooted in our long history of slavery in this country and of racial relations, the civil rights movement. And, yeah, it does make us forget that, you know, there's a lot of other folks who suffer a lot of the same sorts of economic anxieties. You know, this is not necessarily a black or white issue. It is an entirely an issue that divides along gender lines either. But I do think, you know, the experience of people of color, especially people of color of lower incomes, is one that we need to be talking about.
Right. And I also just wanted to ask you, because there's such a focus on, you know, going to rural Pennsylvania, for example, or rural Ohio, when you find dire poverty here in California. In fact, I just got a news release from the Public Policy Institute of California about high child poverty rates in this state. One quarter of California's young children, 754,000, live in poverty.
Yeah, and you know, when in California gets labeled as a very affluent place because of Los Angeles, because of Silicon Valley, and it does make us overlook, you know, just the heterogeneity of different states. You know, there's plenty of wealthy pockets here in Michigan, too. And in fact, oftentimes when people talk about Detroit these days, they're talking about how it's being revitalized. But that revitalization isn't affecting everyone equally. And economic opportunities in California aren't open to just anyone either.
Right. Now, for this book, you focused on 45 women in Detroit, mostly women of color, and you interviewed them over a six-year period. How did you choose these women? How did you find them?
I found them mostly because they had participated in another survey project run here at the University of Michigan by Michael Barr, who's at the law school here. So in some ways, it was a sample of folks who were primarily low and moderate income. So, you know, it was sort of a convenience for me, but in in meeting everyone and talking to them and hearing their stories, you know, I realized that there was, you know, both something special about the experiences they had, but very, you know, their experiences also shared a lot of commonalities, and I felt as if I was tapping into something that was sort of bigger than just these, you know, these 45 women.
And throughout your book, you cite another book called The Truly Disadvantaged by William Julius Wilson. He wrote this in 1987 about urban poverty in Chicago. Can you talk about the significance of that book and why you decided to reference it so many times in yours?
Sure, for a couple of reasons. One, in sociology, which is what I'm trained in, and in specifically in urban sociology, William Julius Wilson's book is sort of, you know, the book. You know, this is where you start when you start talking about experiences of poverty in the United States. And it's held up well over time. It's assigned in sociology classes throughout the country. And in fact, it was, you know, a pretty important book for me personally to help me decide that this, you know, I wanted to do similar kind of research. So it really is kind of a real landmark study that lots of folks refer back to. So in choosing it, you know, there was my own personal connection to it, but I also wanted to think about, like, you know, what has changed, you know, even though a lot of his arguments still hold up. You know, the economy's changed, the political landscape has changed, racial relationships have changed, you know, so what can we learn now using sort of Wilson's framework?
And you write that that book brought the terms concentrated poverty and social isolation into the lexicon mm-hmm. of social scientists studying disadvantaged groups. And you did not intend to study social abandonment when you started out on this project. You write that originally you wanted to find out how welfare reform and expansion of the earned income credit were affecting economically vulnerable families. But you focus on social isolation and social abandonment throughout your book. What really shifted? What happened?
Well, it became so, you know, originally Michigan was in an economic downturn before the rest of the country, and it seemed like, oh, you know, this would provide us with an opportunity to look at how these policy changes really worked and operated in, you know, when there's unemployment, you know, higher than 4%. But it really became clear in just talking to people, you know, the welfare system and welfare reform didn't really play this central part of their daily lives. The recession, you know, was always there, and the economic downturn was there, but, you know, it wasn't sort of the driving force around people's experiences. It was other things. It was, you know, all of the effort they put into trying to go to school and earn an associate's or bachelor's degree, and the limited returns that they saw to that. It was all their efforts to try to, you know, make a better life for their families, and the failures that they encountered, not, you know, necessarily due to what they did, but because of real structural barriers. So it was really something that emerged over time.
And tell us a little bit about Detroit. You write that 40% of the city's residents live in poverty. In 2010, the official unemployment rate was 25%. But some policymakers believe that when you include those who are no longer looking for work, that number is as high as 50%.
Yeah, and, you know, Detroit has been in, you know, some state of economic crisis for decades now, you know, with globalization, with the movement of the auto industry, kind of first out into the suburbs and then overseas. You know, Detroit's been facing a tough time for quite a long time. You know, there aren't, you know, that many jobs in Detroit, but there are jobs. However, for most folks, they tend to be pretty low paying. They tend to be unstable. And that instability plays out in a number of different ways. You know, there might be a lot of turnover among staff. You might be scheduled for 40 hours a week, but you only work 10. You know, so they're not, the jobs that are there are ones that sort of inherently lend themselves to instability, and I think, you know, contribute to some of the high unemployment that we see.
You also write about the changes that are happening in Detroit. These changes are happening in many major cities across the country. In fact, there was a town hall on MSNBC about the gun violence in Chicago, and a number of people who live in poor neighborhoods in Chicago said, well, if you look at the wealthy neighborhoods, they're getting new transit, new buildings, their streets are being cleaned. Lots of great things are happening over there, just not here. And you write that the same thing is happening in Detroit. The women in your study are being abandoned by the, quote, new Detroit. There's a new 3-mile-long rail line being built. It'll only serve downtown and midtown. People in the neighborhoods are left to be serviced by Detroit's abysmal bus system, long known for its delays. Some of the women you interviewed had cars. Others are having car problems, and so it's really hard to get to work. But can you talk a little bit about that, how the new Detroit is affecting and benefiting a lot of people, but not necessarily the women that you interviewed?
Yeah, and you know, some of this is very much due to some deliberate policy choices that leaders in Detroit made. And, you know, to be clear, Detroit needed to do some different things, needed to attract residents. You know, people have been leaving the city, you know, since the 1950s. So there really was a concerted effort to try to make Detroit attractive to younger people, to, you know, sort of people who might otherwise move to a place like San Francisco, but Detroit would be a cheaper option, artists and the like. And so now you've got a situation where you've got a sort of a downtown core that is really well developed. The entertainment scene has just transformed, even in the last 5 years. So you've got folks who live in that area who are not native Detroiters and who often are white, and a lot of people who come in the evenings or on the weekends to do fun stuff. But one thing that is very different, you know, about Detroit, you know, when you compare it to San Francisco, it's very large geographically. So when this one little tiny area is being, you know, sort of developed and resources are being poured into it, it's really hard for that economic development to really benefit people who live in the outer areas, you know, who may live, you know, a half hour to 40 minutes away from the downtown core, and who may have really never been there much in their childhood or adult lives.
Today we're speaking with Kristen Seafelt about her new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. And Kristen focuses on 45 women. She calls them strivers. These are women who work or want more work, longer hours, for example. They go to school, they aspire to be homeowners, some of them own their homes, but despite their efforts to reach middle class status, they remain poor or near poor. Some are clinging to a middle class status, but that could easily be lost. And so we're talking about her book, the women that she interviewed, and, you know, as she writes, this is not just an issue in Detroit. The experiences of these women really illustrate how social abandonment occurs across the country. The job characteristics we see across the country, low wages, schedules that shift from day to day, reduced hours, no benefits, no retirement. There's just a lot of uncertainty in the workplace these days. And Kristen says, as a result, so many people are socially isolated and they've been socially abandoned. And we'd love to hear from you. If this sounds like something that you've experienced, we'd love to hear your story. Also talking about how so many people cannot attain the American dream of home ownership and a college education. What are your thoughts on that? And if you have any, if you've seen any solutions in your community to address these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about these job characteristics, Kristen, because as you said, what's happening in Detroit is happening across the country. People want to work, but sometimes they're getting jobs where they have no idea what their schedules are going to be like. Their wages are low. They don't have benefits. They don't have retirement. And when you have children, that's really difficult because you don't know when you're going to go to work the next week.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Although, you know, surprisingly, very few of the women I talk to, you know, talked about childcare problems. And I think, you know, in reflecting about that, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, their expectations of what a job could offer them were really, you know, very basic. And they felt like they couldn't really even hope for something more, hope for a job that had stable hours, you know, hope a job that had would have benefits was something that was sort of even kind of out of the realm of possibility of envisioning. And even when people had jobs that offered benefits, you know, on their low wages, there was no way they could afford, you know, to pay their share of a health insurance package or contribute to a retirement plan when they needed every penny of their paycheck to try to pay bills.
You write that with the exception of the women in professional salaried positions, most of the jobs held by the women that you interviewed paid low wages of between $10 and $12 an hour. Only 11% had ever worked in a temporary job, one acquired through a staffing agency, and the same number had held a union job.
Right. I mean, the decline of unions in this state and in this country, you know, is well seen through the experiences of the women I interviewed. Something I didn't talk about as much in the book, but that was common, was, you know, a lot of these folks, you know, they'd grown up in Detroit, they'd been born there. They had family members who, you know, worked on the auto lines and were members of unions. And even, you know, for the few women who were able to get similar kinds of positions where they were assembling cars or working in plants that were suppliers, you know, they were lucky if they maybe made $13 an hour. They weren't members of unions, and often they were temporary employees who could be let go very easily when production slowed down.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about when it comes to unions? Did anything else come up in your research just about how the attacks on unions and with Republicans controlling so many states across the country? We're going to see a lot more right-to-work states.
Oh, yeah, and Michigan is one of those right-to-work states. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the narrative that you hear in Southeast Michigan is that, you know, the problem with workers in this state is that they expected to be members of a union, and they, you know, had all these unrealistic expectations about the kind of jobs they could get with just a high school degree. And I don't see that at all. You know, unfortunately, women really seem to, you know, accept the fact that those unionized jobs were not going to be there. And then the other factor that I think is worth bringing up is a lot of the folks worked in jobs that were really what I call isolating. They worked by themselves. They were in jobs like home health care aides where they saw their clients, but they never saw coworkers. They never even saw their supervisor in a few cases. And when you think about trying to, you know, engage in organizing and collective bargaining activities, you have to feel like you're part of something. And a lot of these jobs, you know, were structured in such a way that no one was really interacting with anybody else, you know, who was in their same situation.
What really struck you about the social isolation and the social abandonment? You have sections of your book that specifically focus on that.
You know, I think sort of a popular narrative, and one that William Julius Wilson's original book was sort of grounded in, is that, you know, the problem is that people just aren't, aren't working. They don't have working role models. They're not attached to so-called mainstream institutions. And if they just would be, if they just get jobs, if they would, you know, just behave more like middle-class folks, that if you're low income, you could rise up and do that. But everyone was doing the things that, you know, that the narrative of the American dream tells you you're supposed to do, you know. Maybe not quite in the order of what we kind of come to expect, but, you know, people were finishing high school, they were going to college, they were working, you know, sometimes a couple of different jobs. You know, they were looking into becoming homeowners to have, you know, try to accumulate some sort of nest egg. But the structures of opportunities that these sorts of institutions once provided just, you know, thwarted them in their efforts.
And you write that social abandonment hits the poorest families particularly hard.
Right. I mean, if you are faced with a situation where, you know, you have a health problem that makes it really difficult, if not impossible, to work, and you haven't been able to save up any money along the way, And sometimes if you don't have any children who are below the age of 18, there's just not really a whole lot there for you, right? Our social safety net is, you know, meager that it is built to help people who had stable employment when they lose those jobs through our unemployment insurance system. We have, you know, sort of a cash welfare system and a food stamp system that are easier for low-income folks with kids to access. But if you are an adult without minor age children, you know, and if you're not able, you know, to quickly get on a disability program, there's really not much left for you at all.
You know, the other thing that was striking in your book is you interview women about how difficult it is to get benefits.
Yeah.
Whether the departments have been cut so much by budget cuts, they're not answering their phones, or there's some kind of administrative problem, a mistake, and so benefits stop and then it takes a year just to get them back. I mean, we often hear in the national dialogue by people who are opposed to various programs that these benefits are easy to get and that people game the system. But based on the women that you interviewed, it's really hard to get these benefits.
Very hard. And these were stories that sort of came up organically. You know, I wasn't necessarily asking people to talk about, like, you know, tell me everything that happens when you go to the welfare office. And, you know, it was really striking. And these are folks who lived in different places, who were going to different welfare offices, who had different caseworkers. So it wasn't the case that there was this one particular person, you know, working in the welfare office who was messing things up for everybody. But it was just, you know, really the fortitude that folks had to have, and the patience and the wherewithal to keep, following up month after month, week after week, because if they weren't persistent, you know, no one else was going to be. There was no one really advocating on their behalf when their food stamps got cut off by mistake. You know, no one was really actively trying to fix it for them. They had to, you know, monitor that situation constantly. And in the meantime, you know, there's $300 worth of benefits you don't have for 6 months or a year, and you're trying to figure out how to feed your kids.
You write that when striving women were out of a job and needed money, they could not count on the programs that were supposed to help them. Obtaining benefits often entailed fighting with lawyers, employers, and bureaucrats. Globalization has weakened the connections between employers and employees, but employers and their lawyers, perhaps logically, also contested filings for unemployment benefits and other work-related benefits because these programs could negatively affect their bottom line.
Right. So employers, help contribute to the unemployment insurance system. You know, they contribute to its funding. And one of the ways they do that is if you lay off somebody and they use their UI benefits to which they are entitled, the employer is in effect, you know, taxed at a higher rate. So it costs the employer some amount of money when they engage in layoffs. And this is a very particular and peculiar to the United States way of funding the system. So if you're an employer, you know, especially if you're an employer of low-wage workers who you think might not know about their rights, or if you're doing mass layoffs, you may just decide it's kind of worth your while to just contest the filing, the claims of someone, and hope, you know, that they'll just give up and walk away, and then you, the employer, don't have to be penalized. And we've seen, you know, not much coverage in the media about this, but, you know, there are firms out there that help employers do just this. They help employers, you know, contest the application for benefits of their workers, even in, you know, and this is, you know, across the board, regardless of the merits of the case, so to speak. You know, and it's really a way to discourage folks from using benefits that, you know, that they themselves also paid into.
And just quickly, how does this work in other countries? When we hear about countries with a very strong social safety net, which one would you point to that maybe you'd like to see that system applied here?
Well, you think a lot of the Nordic countries and some Western European countries, you know, it's just part of the tax system, you know, and both taxes on individuals, and which are much more progressive than they are in the U.S., and taxes on businesses. And so, you know, this is sort of the part of the philosophy, and one that I think in our country we don't quite share, is that, you know, you're paying your taxes because you might want to draw upon some of these benefits in the future. You might need to, you know, you're paying ahead for your retirement funds. So there's sort of a shared responsibility, and a collective notion that we're all in this together, and I'm paying for things that I might actually have to use at some point in the future.
Kristen Seifelt reports that caseworkers rarely return phone calls. Many of the women complained that their caseworkers' voicemail boxes were perpetually full, so they couldn't even leave messages. Geneva was once able to leave a voicemail message regarding a question she had, but it took 3 months for the caseworker to call her back. Even if they were able to track down their caseworker and have a conversation, problems might still remain. There are so many stories about the women, 45 women that she interviewed in Detroit, who couldn't get a call back, or they were on Medicaid, and then a clerical error closed their case. Brianna tried in vain to contact her caseworker, but the phone calls were never returned. And, I mean, some of these stories go on for pages about how difficult it is just to get a phone call returned. Today, we're joined by Kristen Seifelt, author of the new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment on the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about Ajit Pai, the new chair of the Federal Communications Commission. He's a former FCC commissioner and a lawyer for Verizon and the government, and he's already done a lot in the past couple of months. He's stopped 9 companies from providing discounted high-speed internet access to low-income households. He withdrew a federal case to cap phone rates in prison, and he says net neutrality's days are numbered. Net neutrality preserves the open internet. So we'll have a conversation about Ajit Pai and what we can expect from the chair of the FCC. Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be talking about media coverage of what's going down at Standing Rock. As we speak, there's about 200 Native Americans and their allies who are still there, and according to reports, they are going to be removed this afternoon. And according to an ABC News report, the company that's building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partner, says the oil could flow in as few as 2 weeks. And so we're going to get an update on what's happening at Standing Rock on Friday's Media Roundtable. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Kristen Seifelt. She's the author of the new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. And over 6 years, Kristen interviewed 45 women living in the Detroit area. She calls them strivers because they work, they want to work longer hours, a full day, not just 4 hours a day, for example, go to school. They aspire to be homeowners. Some of them own their homes. But she writes that despite their efforts to reach middle class status, they remain poor or near poor. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Kristen Seifelt is Assistant Professor of Social Work and Public Policy at the University of Michigan. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. The more I hear, the more questions I have, so I'll try to get it down to just this. the strivers, with the idea of being in the middle class and owning a home, those seem to me to be perks of a job, you know, whatever it is you're doing. Do the 45 women profiled in the book, are these women interested in getting career jobs? Are they looking to be executive secretaries? Are they looking to be nurses or teachers? You know, that's kind of the way you reach that goal. In my mind, I don't know. And also, what industries, where are the growth jobs in the Detroit area?
All right. Thank you, Ruby.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So we haven't really talked yet about sort of the education piece and people's experiences with that. So people, the women that I interviewed really wanted careers. So many of them were working as home health care aides or were certified nurses assistants, you know, and these are sort of entry-level health care jobs. They're also some of the fastest growing jobs, not just in the Detroit area, but in the country. This is where the growth industry is, at a low-wage job. So folks were trying, you know, in school, in programs to try to become an LPN or an RN. But, you know, it's really difficult, and I'm, you know, sure this is an experience that many people can relate to. It's hard to go to school and work and take care of your kids. And also folks, you know, sometimes ended up in for-profit institutions, which gave them degrees, but also, you know, these degrees were not really ones that had any market value. Employers didn't seem to value a degree from, you know, an online for-profit institution in the same way they would, you know, value the degree from a, you know, University of California, Berkeley, or a University of Michigan. So folks often, like, got themselves into deep debt. And the jobs they could find after completing their degree, if they were able to finish it, you know, were ones that, as one of the women, Yvette, said, you know, I'm barely making, you know, I'm barely in a job above, a step above McDonald's. You know, mm-hmm. she had been a low wage worker. You know, all she could get was a sales job, even though she had a bachelor's degree, and it was a low paying sales job where most of her income was contingent on commissions. So, you know, yes, people absolutely wanted careers and were actively taking steps to try to get there, but it was just very, very difficult.
And just to stick with education for a minute, you write that most of the 45 women that you interviewed who held loans had also received federal financial aid to pay for their schooling, but for a variety of reasons, the aid had not been enough. Sometimes grants and scholarships did not cover the full cost of the program, even if the student was enrolled in a lower cost institution, like a community college, for example. The aid she received through programs like the Pell Grant paid for school-related expenses, but that's it. And one of the women you interviewed, Brianna, stopped working when she was in an associate's degree program.
Yeah, I mean, she had been working part-time, full-time, trying to juggle school with her work responsibilities, with her parenting responsibilities, and had decided near the end of her education, she, you know, and the result of that was, and this was the case for many women, it just was taking so long. You know, if you can only take a couple classes at a time, you know, a 2-year degree becomes really something that takes 6 to 7 years. And so she wanted to speed up the process. So she decided, you know, to take out a loan so she could pay her living expenses, her rent, her utilities, you know, her car insurance. You know, so even though she had financial aid and her community college costs, you know, very low tuition, low costs, you know, for fees and other things like that, you know, she still went into debt just because she, you know, she felt the need to really get ahead quicker.
Next fall, City College in San Francisco will be free for people who live in San Francisco. And Bernie Sanders still is talking about free college tuition in the United States. According to The Atlantic, it would cost about $40 billion. Let's imagine for a minute that higher education was free and attainable for the women that you interviewed. How would that affect their lives?
I think it would have the potential to affect their lives tremendously, but I'll, like, you know, put an asterisk on that. I think there also has to be some real investment in the schools that people are going to. Community colleges, by and large, are really underfunded. When I look at the cost per pupil that comes in for a student at the University of Michigan versus our local community college, the gap is really quite wide. But we know that the average student who goes to a community college has a lot more educational needs than the average student, going to a flagship school. We need more investment, resource investment in the colleges themselves so that they can better serve their students, so that they can provide real advising and guidance to people. A lot of folks who were in school didn't know they had advisors. So when they would kind of decide, I'm going to switch my major, switch my focus, there was no one there to help them really understand, well, what's the implications, both financial and time-wise, of making some of these changes? Or is there someone who can help me navigate the world of financial aid, or, help me figure out what I'm most interested in? So really, I think in investing in schools is also really needed.
You also interviewed Leah, who is a social worker employed by the state of Michigan, and she and her husband owe more than $100,000 in student loans for graduate professional school. And although their combined income put them over six figures, so she was at the top of the women that you interviewed, mm-hmm. Leah hoped that she would have some of her student loans forgiven.
Yeah, so there are, and students in the School of Social Work here at Michigan are told about this right off the bat. If you are in certain kinds of professions where you are, kind of expected to make low wages, or you're doing, working in certain underserved communities, so social workers and some doctors who work in areas of the country that are underserved can have their student loans forgiven. The catch is, though, you have to basically make payments on those loans, for 10 years. So while that does make a difference, and I don't want to, downplay that at all, you're still out of pocket a lot of money each month, to pay for a degree for professions that we really need, but that we, that are underpaid themselves.
What about Ruby's question about jobs in the Detroit area?
Jobs in the Detroit area are, in terms of job growth, a lot of the same sort of trends that we're seeing other places in the country. A lot of the growth is in lower paying jobs. So the entry level healthcare jobs, the home healthcare aides, the certified nurses assistants. There's some growth in some parts of the manufacturing sector, but that also, these are higher tech kind of jobs where you need a more advanced degree and a lot of training to get them. They're not the assembly line jobs, of the 20th century. Plenty of economic growth, but it's economic growth in jobs that really pay pretty poorly.
And that's the trend that we're seeing across the country. We often hear about the jobs that are being created, but we don't really hear about what kind of jobs those are. And a lot of studies show that so many of the jobs created under the Obama administration are the jobs you're talking about, low-wage sector jobs with no benefits and no retirement.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where the bulk of the economic growth in terms of jobs has taken place. It's not in the so-called, good jobs. It's in jobs that really make it very difficult, to make ends meet.
So what does this mean? I mean, can you talk more about what's to come if this is obviously the trend? I mean, it sounds like the women that you interviewed are really on the front lines of what's a national trend here. Women who really want to work, they want more hour, like they want a full day's work. They want to go to school if possible. They're doing all the right things, and yet they still cannot get ahead.
Yeah, I think a couple different things come to mind. Some of these jobs we need, right? Like especially with an aging population, we probably need more home healthcare aides. But maybe we should reevaluate, what's the appropriate pay, for someone who is essentially taking care of a family member, of someone who's out doing another job. Don't we value that kind of job? Shouldn't we be paying more than $8 or $9 an hour for someone who's providing such an essential service? So that's one sort of thing. If we're not going to do that, can we do more work through the tax code to, you know, make sure that we're not taxing low-wage workers to death, or, and in fact, increasing maybe their refunds like we do currently through the Earned Income Tax Fund refund. But that's part of the safety net. Can we do more to bolster the safety net so that we're, in effect, supplementing people's wages who the market pays too little? And if we're going to really, talk about like individual responsibility, we need to tear down some of the barriers that make it so hard for people to go back to school and get degrees that are actually worth something.
You write about Rhonda, who is a home health aide. She's working in one of the fastest growing labor sectors. What did she make an hour?
I want to say she made around, she had a number of different positions, but usually I want to say like anywhere from $9 to $11 an hour.
Wow. So really the wages haven't really changed. I was just looking at a New York Times story about home health aides, what they make. The average back in 2008 was about $8 an hour. Mm-hmm. So the wage hasn't really, $3 an hour is something, but it hasn't really changed that much.
No, it's a growth position in terms of the number of jobs available. It doesn't appear to be a growth position in terms of wage growth.
And what would you say are some solutions? Because we're seeing massive inequality with so much wealth being concentrated at the very top, while the women that you interviewed are struggling to make ends meet. What kinds of policy changes would you like to see? Because you write that so much of this social isolation and the social abandonment has been caused by policies over the decades.
Well, like I mentioned before, I think, more investment in some of our educational systems that do tend to serve more economically disadvantaged folks would be terrific. More ability for folks to, actually go to school and concentrate on school. It's sort of just an artifact of the way we've set things up that's something we afford to our 18 to 22-year-olds who sort of fit the mold of a so-called typical college student, but that actually isn't the typical college student anymore. And so kind of rethinking the way we fund education, not just at the institutional level, but, for people who want to go back and who want to advance their skills. It's sort of crazy to expect that, somebody can work 40 hours a week and attend classes and study for 40 hours a week and also try to raise their family. I do think we need to really be thinking about a higher minimum wage, a much higher minimum wage. You can't live on $8 an hour or $9 an hour, and it's difficult to live on $9 an hour, even if you are getting a variety of public assistance benefits, and then you can't count on those. So, shoring up our public benefit system so that if people are using food stamps, for example, they don't need to worry about having them cut off all the time. I never want to sound like I'm trashing folks who work for the welfare system, because it's a terrible, tough job to be in. There's been a lot of cutbacks in the staffing of social service agencies, so it is really difficult, and that's just part of the disinvestment. And I do think we need to rethink our income distribution or redistribution or lack thereof. It's not as if folks' stories illustrate a lack of trying or a lack of wherewithal. They're striving, but the resources to achieve their dreams are just so bare.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how the system fails these women? Last year we had on a guest, Caroline Fredrickson, who wrote a book called Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she writes about the fact that women make up 53% of the low-wage economy, and the majority are in jobs that do not have any legal protections.
Yeah, and that was readily evident when I would talk to folks about their jobs. That the balance of power between employers and the employee has really, you know, it's never really been an equal balance, right? But at least when there were more union jobs, when there was more collective bargaining, there were more protections for workers. And now this notion that everyone's an at-will employee, I think has really kind of just, it's changed dynamics, you know, and people, you know, plenty of women who would quit jobs because they were worried they were going to be fired, and that you know, they didn't want that on their resume at all, and they didn't feel like they had any rights, any way to voice concerns about real actual workplace violations. You know, having, if you worked in a nursing home, having to take care of too many patients according to actual state regulations, or being asked to do certain things on your job that were dangerous to do. People would do them, or they would quit jobs because they just felt like they had no voice at all.
Mm. Today, we're speaking with Kristen Seafelt about her new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. Kristen is assistant professor at the University of Michigan, professor of social work and public policy. And we have an email from Leanne who says, are there any cities in the United States that don't have these problems? Is it due to the size of the city? Is there a city that you would consider a positive model?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to look at what will happen in the city of Seattle, where the minimum wage is being raised incrementally, and where there's been other policies put in place that are in hopes of benefiting low-wage workers. San Francisco with a workers' bill of rights, you know, I think we'll need to see how that plays out over time. But you know, I think there's a limit to what a particular city on its own can do when a lot of the rules that govern funding for certain programs are made at a state level or at a federal level. And as it is right now, if a city raises its minimum wage, a low-wage worker could potentially be made worse off because rules of federal public assistance programs haven't been changed. So, you know, you might earn too much and you lose more in benefits than you would actually gain because you got a raise.
What do you expect we're going to see in the next couple of years with Donald Trump in power and Republicans in power across the country in many states? I was just reading about a law in Iowa that would freeze the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour and strip local counties and cities of their ability to set their own wage limits. These are Republicans who say they're in favor of states' rights, but when states pass these minimum wage increases, they go after them.
Yeah, and, you know, I do think, as you mentioned earlier, we're probably going to see, you know, more states implement right-to-work laws. That Iowa example, even if it's extreme, I don't see a lot of movement at the state level to do more increases in minimum wages. The states that were going to and have been increasing them may continue to do so, but the states that haven't thus far, I don't see that happening absent some sort of federal mandate to do so. At the federal level, I worry a lot about some of the proposals that are out there to block grant programs like food stamps, which right now is sort of the only real safety net program that exists, and block grant Medicaid, because I think it would just mean the loss of these benefits for thousands and thousands of people in every state. Or if the benefits aren't lost, it would really mean that benefits would be cut way back. You hear a lot in the news about, repealing of ACA, and that will, could have some real negative effects on a whole lot of folks. But keeping Medicaid but changing its funding structure in such a way that states will have a real incentive to cut back on benefits, could be very, very harmful.
And union activists told the Village Voice that they're really concerned about a national right-to-work bill. It's been introduced many times in the past but hasn't gone anywhere. But now that the Republicans control the House and the Senate, there's a possibility that it could go somewhere. And this various versions are on the books in 28 states, but this federal law would eliminate union security clauses.
Well, that's, that will not be good for the remaining 11% of workers who are covered by unions. Although, we have so much policy has already chipped so much away. And even folks who still belong to unions have had, their ability to bargain has really been undermined already.
Did the women in that you interviewed, the 45 women, do they vote? Are they politically engaged at all?
They were very politically engaged. When I was interviewing folks right around the time that Obama was first campaigning for president, there were folks who were out volunteering. Definitely all voters very aware of what was going on in the news, often would remark, though, that they found it very, very depressing and felt very, very much abandoned by policymakers and politicians. Felt as if, no one was really listening to them, or if they were, talking about them, they were piling upon them very negative and hurtful stereotypes.
And are you in touch with any of them today? Is there a specific story in our remaining minute that really stands out for you that you'd like to share?
For the folks that I am still in touch with, I would say, things are still basically the same. Mm-hmm. Nothing's necessarily gotten much worse, but, with the economic recovery, still chugging along, it's not as if that's helped anybody's situation really improve. A few folks have left the state to try to find better economic opportunities elsewhere, but it's not clear that that's really panned out as they had hoped.
And do you plan to keep in touch with them to see how things are going in the coming years?
I hope to.
Kristen Seafelt is author of the book Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. And over a six-year period, she interviewed 45 women in Detroit, mostly women of color. She calls them strivers. They are trying to get ahead. They're working. They want to work a full day. They attend school. They're aspiring to be homeowners. Some own their home. But despite their efforts to reach middle-class status, they remain poor or near poor. Kristen Seafelt is assistant professor of social work and public policy at the University of Michigan. Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for your work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about Ajit Pai, the new chair of the FCC. He's a former commissioner and a lawyer for Verizon. And so far, he has stopped 9 companies from providing discounted high-speed internet access to low-income households. He also withdrew a federal case to cap phone rates in prisons. And he says that net neutrality's days are numbered. Net neutrality preserves an open internet. So tomorrow we'll find out more about him and what we can expect from the new FCC chair. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Stephanie Porcel is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you for joining us.